Can you imagine what it feels like to be a Canadian soccer player as Peter Pendergast blows the whistle? It's official. Canada 2000 Gold Cup champions. How does that sound?
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
Yes, it's episode 36 of the Northern Football Podcast. I'm Peter Galindo with Thomas Neff and my friend. We thought we were going to have a busy show before the week finished. Then Gareth Wheeler of One Soccer drops a teaser that captivated Canadian soccer fans for hours, and then the CSA finally dropped the bomb.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. None of us ever thought UBA was eligible. We'll talk more of that on later. But it's absolutely incredible because with this roster, Canada looks to not only strengthen the pool, but so much more, you know, can come out of this. And obviously, we have some clips from Herdman as well. Super excited for the game coming up. Costa Rica has some news as well. And the CPL is wrapping up, MLS decision day, that and so much more. And again, thank you so much for the support as we continue to get so much messages the past couple of days. But you're not going to want to miss this packed show.
Definitely not. And for sure, you guys continue to flood the Northern Football Twitter account. But we love that because it makes our jobs a lot easier because we tailor the show to what you guys want to hear. So let's dive into all of this. Just before we do, a reminder to you all that the Northern Football Podcast is partnered with Northern Tribune. Check out their website at northerntribune.ca for all the latest Canadian soccer news and analysis, and follow them on Twitter at North Tribune. Also, please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If that platform is Apple, then leave us a rating and review as well. So as we touched on to kick off the show, Canada unveiled a 23-man squad for November qualifiers against Costa Rica and Mexico in Thomas Neff's hometown of Edmonton. The big takeaway, though, from that roster announcement, I guess even before that roster announcement, was the commitment of 23-year-old Genk striker Ike Ugbo, who was eligible to play for Nigeria as well as England, and previously expressed his interest in representing Nigeria as early as basically a few months ago. Now, I want to apologize to the listeners because we were asked a question regarding Ugbo's eligibility. I had seen various sources say he lived in Canada from age 5 to 9, whereas he ended up actually telling Cercle Bruges, which was his previous club before Genk, that he lived here from, and I'm quoting him directly, 4 or 5 years old. So throw in that with the now twice changed FIFA nationality laws, and you have a very confusing situation. Because as it turns out, FIFA now allows a change of nationality if a player lived in a particular country for 3 years before the age of 10, which Ugbo obviously did. Canada Soccer also indicated on Twitter that his parents, or one of them, were of Canadian descent, but there's no exact confirmation on that. Switching back to Ugbo's commitment though, Thomas, given that we have discussed how few out-and-out number nines Canada has in this current player pool, how important is it for the program to add him to the ranks?
Oh, it is absolutely huge, Peter. With Cavallini basically in no form and Jevison still not committing, David looks like the only number nine option. Brim did not cut it for me, in my opinion. And we are really in need of a second number nine option, and Ugbo looks to solve all those problems. We know Ennin, there was the talk of maybe him being called up. But again, even if he does play as a number nine in the Russian Premier League, he's nowhere near the impactful player that Ugbo is. And he's not scoring goals as well. So, and I have to say, back to your original comment about apologizing to listeners. Same thing for me. I mean, I looked at this guy in the last 2 years, probably like 3-4 times. And again, it only did say that he was from 5 to 9. But you need to be here at least 5 years in order to be eligible. But again, with all of the rules changing in FIFA, I have to give credit to John Herdman. It is absolutely incredible how he just jumped on this in September, even August. He said that he was doing all the necessary paperwork to switch to Nigeria. And obviously, we know that Nigeria are a team that go to World Cups and one of the best in Africa. But for Herdman to just jump on this and say, hey, you want to play with Canada? Here's the opportunity and whatnot. It's incredible because he did this in the last, and it took him 2 years, and we'll have more information about that later, but it took him 2 years to convince him. And by then he was an England youth international. He was even stonewalled by Chelsea, you know, pretty much given all that. But Herman, I mean, the fact that he was able to do this in the circumstances that he did, with no one finding out about it, is incredible to me.
Well, I may have a bit of a devil's advocate role to play later on when we discuss one of our listener questions with this, because I don't think it was entirely, Herdman convincing Ugbo and this and that. Like, I think there were other elements at play here. But no doubt about it, it's a solid commitment for the team. If only because it provides another approach for Herdman to use now that he has a poacher's profile in Ugbo. Plus, he's playing in a solid league. He's 23 years old. He'll be part of the national team program for the next 10 years. So you're not only getting a player for now in your road to Qatar, but also 2026 and 2030 and obviously beyond that potentially. So that is in itself a really solid recruit to have. But obviously it is massive, as that was one of the thinner areas of the squad, and now that has been pretty much addressed at this point. So let's dive into some of your questions, listeners. Jonathan Bryson asked, "Can we please get a scouting report on Ugbo? I can't say that I have much of one." So before I give my thoughts, I wanted to hear straight from the horse's mouth what Ugbo could provide to Canada. So I asked John Herdman how Ugbo could complement not just the other forwards in the squad, but just the team in general. Here's what Herdman answered with.
He's an out-and-out number nine. He likes to play, between the two center backs. He likes to lead the line. He can run behind the line and stretch the line, which I like. I think that's it's a facet that can help complement other players and the way that we play. Often when we play with that number nine in Johnny or Kyle, they want to be receiving in those pockets of space off the front. And at times we get left with a line that's not stretched, that space doesn't really open up. So I think EK gives us that opportunity. And then you see him, he's an absolute poacher in the box. He's got just that real predatory instinct between the penalty spot and goal. He all the goals he scores are just clever movements. He gets those positional advantages to create opportunities in, and he's young. He's young, Peter. He's got, as I say, I think he's going to keep evolving over the next 2, 3 years. He's playing at one of the top clubs in Belgium, and he's got a plan in his mind about, where he wants to get in his career, and Canada's part of that plan.
So Herman mentioned, of course, that he is a predator in the box. That checks out when you watch his movement. He's so good at creating separation from defenders, anticipating a pass, and getting in position. And given how many players Canada has who drive to the byline or into the box and then cut it back for a forward, Ugbo could thrive as a number nine in this system. Like, from Richie Larea to Tejon Buchanan to Alphonso Davies, and more. These guys are going to give Ugbo the service that he needs. Even with 300 minutes for Genk across 10 appearances, he's still averaging about 0.6, 0.7 XG per 90. I know it's a very small sample size, but even though he's being used quite sparingly for his new club, he's still getting in promising positions to score. And that is very encouraging, because normally when a striker is not getting regular minutes, or getting 10 minutes here, 20 minutes there, it's hard to get consistent scoring chances, and yet he's still doing that. He's very quick, he has long strides, solid enough in the air, unlike a Jonathan David, for example. And despite a heavy touch, Ugbo is still involved in the build-up, maybe not to the level of a David or a Larin, but he will still do it. On the flip side of that heavy touch lets him down a lot when he's receiving with his back to goal. And that's why he's suited as a player who can run onto a pass or just receive it in the box first time, create that separation, and then shoot. His composure is still lacking a bit, but I prefer a striker who gets in position to score regularly. Eventually, he will finish off the chances. And maybe now that he is at a big club in Belgium on a permanent basis for the first time in his career since leaving Chelsea, perhaps maybe that will come with time.
Yeah, and look, he has 18 goals in 41 games in the Belgian league, so his goal scoring record is there. And listening to Herman's comments about him, he's expecting big things. And like you said, he's 23 years old. He'll be part of the next three cycles going forward. And the fact that he had the possibility, of getting a move to Genk, Right now, he hasn't quite made an impact at Genk yet. You know, not playing as much as he did at Bruges, at Cercle Bruges, that is. But like you said, it will take time. I would have rather, you know, in his individual career, because he hasn't been a Canada player for long. But we'll see how much he really plays in his club game, right? At the same time, he's still in much better form than someone like Cavallini. But like you have to say, the depth that Canada has is much welcoming.
It is. Now, let's get into what I think is going to be a very interesting conversation here. We got a couple of questions from Nick as well as Brennan Delaney, who basically asked the same question, but essentially, does adding Ugbo or a player like him increase the chances of getting more dual nationals or change the minds of other players who could play for other countries, like, say, a Daniel Jeppesen or a Lucas Dias or a Marcelo Flores? What do you think about this?
So this kind of commitment actually reminds me of a lot of U.S. commitments. And the reason I say that is because there's so many players that the U.S. has that have double passports because obviously different circumstances and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. is able to pull guys that did not spend much time in Canada and players that maybe didn't have as much of a connection with the country. Again, we still don't know Ugbo's full story, but it does feel similar because it's a player that we didn't even know we had in the first place. So if there's more players, and Herman did hint that there's more players, I have a feeling there's more players than the ones that we know of.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. The Flores, Jefferson, the Smiths, the Diaz. So if Herman said right off the top that, hey, there's more guys that he knows now because he is aware of this new FIFA rule, mm-hmm. then I have a feeling like it's going to be a domino effect. And the whole thing about Canada needing, you know, to renovate itself, even guys like Laren, who's, you know, on the younger side, but someone like Cavallini, who probably has, you know, one more cycle, but there's only not too many players that are going to be gone after the 22 cycle. So when you look at that, like every single player that Herman's bringing in, if you look at the trend of dual nationals, has been under the age of 23.
Yeah, for the most part.
So when you look at that, I mean, he's targeting specific young players. Now, if you were to bring over, obviously, Ferreras, you know, it's a case of one of a bunch.
Yeah.
He committed him when he was already injured. But even if you were able to bring a more established player, like you said, he can only give you that for a specific amount of years. So it's going to be exciting. But at the same time, Herman did say, and I think this is very important here, that there's a big difference between real conversations and non-real conversations.
Yes.
Guys like Flores, and I'm calling out his dad specifically because the kid is not at fault here.
Of course.
He used a preliminary provisional squad just to get on Tata Martino's nerves and say, hey, Canada's interested. What about the U20 call? And then he gets the U20 call. I'm not going to judge Jefferson just quite yet. Maybe he wants to continue that process with England, but I do think that he's not completely certain. Otherwise, he would have been. Although him being in Liam Miller's comments, I mean, kind of suggests otherwise. as some of you listeners have actually pointed out to us, but again, I have a feeling that you talking to the ESS camp and, you know, whatnot and guys like Smith, that there is that turn of the tide.
There is, but you mentioned a great point. When it comes to players like Jeppesen and Flores and anyone in that situation where, certainly in Flores' case, you have family pressure, maybe, like, say, and I'm not saying that this is the case at all, but Lucas Dias, you know, grew up with Portuguese parents in a Portuguese household, has lived in Portugal since he was 11. He's ingrained in the culture. These kinds of players, and this is where I feel like recruiting guys like Ugbo does have a decent long-term effect in some ways, but I don't think it influences everybody. Because at the end of the day, every dual national situation is different. For example, the Portuguese Canadians who committed to Canada or Junior Hoylett, they previously had their preferences to play for their parents' countries or for, you know, in Hoylett's case, England, which was never possible in the first place. But once they were taken off the table for a variety of different reasons, they then opted for Canada, which was probably their plan B all along. That doesn't mean they're settling for Canada per se, but that is where family reasons or, you know, whatever the case is, drive these players' decisions sometimes. And when you look at Ugbo specifically here, he pledged his international future to Nigeria just a few months ago. So why the switch now? And I think I have the answer here. If you look at Nigeria's striker depth, they have Victor Osimhen, Kelechi Iheanacho, Taiwo Iwoniyi and Terem Mofi, all thriving in top five leagues. All of them are around Ugbo's age. And they're like banging in the goals, Thomas. Like pretty much all those guys are. He also has a teammate, Ugbo, at Genk, who plays for Nigeria. So perhaps they talked. Ugbo saw the glut of strikers and thought, well, this could be tricky to crack. Maybe Canada is the next best option. So he explored that further. And obviously Canada has to have clout. The player has to be enticed by the project, the coach, and the team has to have good players. That is where having those players makes Canada a solid plan B in some situations, like for Ike Ugbo and then potentially someone else down the line. But some players will have a priority, and only when it's no longer viable do they look at the solid plan B that is Canada and say, yeah, let's do it. Like, this is all a roundabout way of saying, like, it has a long-term impact, but in some situations, you're not going to convince everyone because every situation is unique.
It is, and I do agree with that, but again, one of the things that Herman says and touches on, even if a player like Diaz were to get even one cap with Portugal, or Flores, just two caps with Mexico, it increases their value significantly.
Yeah.
In terms of club career, in terms of, you know, getting a bigger contract. So Herman did touch this, and he said that agents and player circles and the player themselves want to make as much money as possible within their career. And I think that's true.
Yeah, of course.
Because obviously players can only play for a certain period of time, most of them 10 to 12, 15 years, at least at the top of the level. Even guys like Liam Miller, like for example, he had an invitation to play for the England youth national team. Someone like Jebison's playing for the England youth national team. Just by being a youth national team player for England rises your stock. And things like that is why players sometimes delay the process, as you were mentioning, Peter, and then look at things, okay, well, it's not possible. The depth is just too much, or they're not interested in me. And then they look at Canada. Again, I keep saying this reminder because the U.S. has pulled so many dual nationals that were born and raised in other countries that happen to have an American passport. And I feel like Canada could be within that same trend. And it doesn't matter if their connection with the country isn't as big. Like, if they can help us win, they can help us win. And like you said, the number nine situation is much different than the winger situation right now. But again, I think that could change.
Moving on to a question here from Stefan Jordan. Between Ugbo and Jebison, speaking of the man himself, who would have the higher ceiling? Thomas, I would think that just based on his age, you would have to say Jebison, and he's made pretty good strides recently. There's even talk that he could return to Sheffield United in January. That's how good he's doing at Burton these days. So if he gets the opportunity in the championship, all the more reason why Jebison has the higher ceiling. But Ugbo still has great potential, no question, especially if he can lock down a starting place and work on his composure in front of goal.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. Like, if you compare Jebison at 18 years of age, compares to Ugbo with 18 years of age, yes, Chelsea's system is tough to crack. And there's probably been, like, how many players have come out of the Chelsea system? You know, at this point, God, being part of the Chelsea, former Chelsea product doesn't mean anything anymore. Because they've loaned like 200 players. But talking specifically about this case, like, it is true. I mean, 18 years of age, three goals already in League One. And I was actually surprised, and I told you this, I was surprised why he went to League One and why he didn't just play in the Championship this year. But if he's coming back to Sheffield, and look, I mean, his desire is to come back to Sheffield and play in the Championship this year. But again, I mean, Ugbo, I think not every player's path is the same. Some players explode differently. And, yep. And again, 18 to 23, that's 5-year difference. Mm-hmm. But at the same time as well, like, Ugbo's more mature. And look, I mean, the Belgian League, you can compare the Belgian League all you want with League One, which one is higher per se. But you also have to compare the clubs. I mean, Burton Albion, Genk, you can also make that comparison. But, you know, Jebison already made his Premier League debut. He scored in the Premier League as well. Ugbo was never near close to that sort of, you know, early start. So it's tough to say, but you have to say because of the age, Jebison has the higher Nadia.
Indeed. Moving over to another question here from Brennan Delaney. Why have there been so many Canadians that came from the Belgian League? And should a Belgian club look to add a CPL affiliate in a town such as Brampton? That might not be a half bad idea if Brampton becomes a viable expansion city for the CPL. But in terms of why there have been so many Canadians that come from the Belgian League, it's actually quite straightforward. Belgian clubs, because of their place in the footballing pyramid in Europe, tend to scout the lesser heralded regions to find value. And right now, Canada still is one of those countries. And even if you just look at Ugbo's club in Genk, they have Mark McKenzie, who they signed from the Philadelphia Union. They have a couple of Colombians who were somewhat unheralded, but have some potential. A couple of Norwegians, a Japanese player, a Slovakian, and a Ghanaian. It's very much a League of Nations at Genk. And even Club Bruges, where Tejan Buchanan's going to play, they have him. They have a Venezuelan wonderkid in Daniel Perez, and Venezuela is not exactly known as like a major footballing nation. Canada's still largely untapped, and the fact that this is a solid stepping stone league just makes it the perfect combination for Canadians to start their European career.
Yeah, and you, I kind of laugh at that, the whole Brampton comment, because again, they're just like that, the talent pool on that city is huge, and I can attest to it, you know, from calling a combine there, and it's incredible how much talent there is in that city. But you know, the whole thing about the Belgian league, you bring up a good point, because the top five leagues, the clubs in top five leagues will go for the A-level countries and that A-level talent, Brazil, Argentina, I could go on and on. And like you say, Belgium and leagues like Holland, Portugal, you know, either go for those A-level countries, but they also look at B and C just because those players are not being looked at. And I think that now, I do think that And I know this for a fact. I know they do have scouts in North America, but it wouldn't be a bad idea, like you said, to scout Canada more often.
Well, that could probably change, right? Especially if they qualify for the World Cup and whatnot. And obviously more Canadians continue to have success in Europe and in MLS. Before long, there's going to be way more attention. Over to a question from Dan Clark. With this announcement, what true weaknesses are there with this team when everyone is healthy? More center-back depth would be nice, but otherwise, this is as complete of a team as any in CONCACAF. Dan, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the options are solid, don't get me wrong, but the depth and quality at center-back is lacking compared to pretty much everywhere from goalkeeper to fullback to the forwards. And also, if you consider, in terms of match-fit players for January, there's really only four viable options at center-back right now. That's Scott Kennedy, Derek Cornelius, Stephen Vitoria, and then Mandrakar James. And two of those guys play in the same position, left-sided center-back. So there's really nobody else you can kind of call on. So that's where you probably want to have a little more depth.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this the other day. For January, Herdman's going to have to get very, very creative to build out that back four. You know, he's probably going to have to bring some forwards, you know, to play as fullback. But you bring up a good point. Without Kamal Miller and without Daniel Henry, that center back depth doesn't look as deep as, you know, it once was, right? And even a guy like Kennedy, you know, he is a left-footed center back, and so is Cornelius. But to bring a guy like James, who's playing for the bottom team of the Danish Super League and has caps, you sort of expect someone like Kennedy and Vitoria to just kind of take the load, the heavy load for those three matches in January, and hope that, you know, guys like Cornelius and James aren't counted upon.
100%, 100%. This question does actually tie in quite nicely with our poll. With Ugbo's commitment, where do you rank Canada's squad on paper in CONCACAF? Most of you were staying conservative and voted in favor of third. That's about 55% of you picked this option out of 330-plus votes. 32% or so were bolder and said second best. 11.1% said it's the best in the region right now. And about 2.1% said fourth or lower. And you guys actually submitted a variety of opinions here, which is actually quite nice for the show to have. Aru Yan said, has to be better than the current USA roster for November, especially since there is no Dest and Reyna, and they have no chemistry. Rude Trude, I think we're third on paper, but with the coaching and culture that's been created, we're maybe first or second. Afrikaans, I think on paper our roster is top three. A team like Jamaica might have a few bigger names, similar to the US. The coaching is left wanting. If all things remain the same, I believe Canada should be considered 2-3 with your choice of USA, Mexico in CONCACAF. And Kurt Thiessen said he voted second on form, but in reality, we are third until results warrant it. That could very well happen after these next two games. So, Thomas, where do you stand on this?
Well, there's two components here. One is the quantity and one is the quality. The US and Mexico by far have the biggest quantity and the biggest quality. I'm still not convinced by the fact that they are the better coach team. And I still think Canada still lacks top five league players. I've been saying this for the longest time possible. And I think in this new year, and if Canada does make the World Cup, which I think they will, this will change. You will have guys that are playing in Belgium that will move to that top five league, or guys in MLS that will move to top five leagues. Sooner or later, Peter, I think it has to happen, because I find it incredible how, you know, countries like Japan and Korea had really good World Cup appearances just recently in 2018. And you look at the roster and they have players playing in mid-table Bundesliga clubs and mid-table Liga uh-huh. clubs. And they're having good performances because mm-hmm. they have the players playing week in, week out against top five, top six opposition in Germany and France and other countries. And I think it has to be said that sooner or later, again, I sound like a broken record, but sooner or later that needs to happen, because we have to compete not only at the top of CONCACAF, but against the rest of the world. And right now, yes, we are third, but I do think that the guys that are coming through, like Larea, like Johnston, like Kay, Eustachio, Crepo, could be playing in these better leagues. We just need the right club, coach, or whatever agent to just give them an opportunity, because they can play in these leagues.
They can, that's for sure, and you make some very good points there. I pretty much side with what the listeners decided. I think Canada's still third. This squad is still probably third best, but if you were to tie in the other factors, yeah, you can make an argument that they're second, but just on the squad alone, I think they're still third, and but the gap is starting to close a little bit, you would have to say. A third question from Brennan Delaney. Are there any dual national Canadians that aren't talked about a lot? And are there any other duals that are center backs? In terms of the center backs, there really aren't. And that's kind of the issue here. When you kind of look towards the future, who's going to replace someone like Steven Vitoria? The options are kind of thin right now. But in terms of the unheralded dual nationals, one that jumps to mind is Georgi Atanasov at Arda in Bulgaria. He's 17, a winger who can play on the right or the left. He's a little further along than someone like, say, a Dominik Yankov was at this age. And I'd argue even now he's a bit further ahead than Dominik Yankov. He's just not been playing a lot recently for the first team, which is a little disappointing, because I thought he looked pretty solid in his 400, 500 minutes or so last season with the first team. Some other names, Yigal Brook from West Vancouver, 19-year-old forward midfielder. He's in the Schalke system right now, playing for their reserves. Federico Rosa, who is 17, Argentinian-Canadian, plays as a number 10 or forward. He's at Belis, and he is banging in the goals over there. Like, it's like there's no tomorrow. Geronimo Sabatasso, 17, midfielder. He's at Empoli's U18s. He looks like a pretty promising player himself. And then Eskander Zugi, who is actually represented by Obelisk in Quebec. He is a young fullback slash winger who has been called up by Tunisia's under-20s. He has a lot of potential himself. But there are so many youngsters in big academies worldwide that it's hard to pick just a few. But those are some of the names that kind of first came to mind when this question came up. And also, Brennan asked about a specific centre-back prospect, Malik Owolabi-Balewu, 19 years old, in the SPAL system. He is actually one who could now be eligible for Canada under these new rules, although I believe he was born here. He covers a lot of ground very, very quickly with his long strides. He's tall, always has his head up when he's in possession, which aids his vision, which is quite, quite good. Reads the game well defensively. Still the odd issue with his positioning, which leaves gaps in between the defense. But overall, very solid body of work. Not the smoothest on the ball, which could probably be aided by him maybe pushing the ball a little further forward ahead of him when he carries it, because it can get caught under his feet sometimes. But certainly a lot of promise. We got a similar question here from Tej Sandhu, who wants to know how we see the next generation of centre-backs. He can only think of a few in Julian Dunn, Rocco Romeo, Juvi Kooner, and Bilal Halbouni. He also mentioned Malik Owolabi as well. Thomas, how do you see that this next generation of centre-backs here?
Again, it's raw. We can't get too caught up with the names at the specific clubs that they are in, because There's a guy named Alessandro Busti. You might know him. He's playing at Juventus, and his career went downhill. So while I do think it is impressive that Canadians are at big academies, it doesn't tell the full picture. And I think that centre-back is the weakest position. I've been saying this for quite some time now. Even when I spoke to Henry, he denied it. But, you know, it is true. and again, I mean, they're never going to say that it is the weakest position. But and it is. And even after Vitória retires, after this cycle, which I think he will, I think we'll manage okay. But it is somewhat concerning, Peter, that there is no clear name, clear number one that's number one or two that's coming up the system, and you're like, okay, this guy will be big. Like, there is, like, all the newer talents are all attacking players.
Yep.
It's great. Don't get me wrong. I love it. The day that, you know, the next Fakayo Tomori pops out, Peter, like, I will celebrate that commitment more than a Flores or a Jefferson. And I say that in the most honest way possible.
Look, a lot can change in the next year or two, like, especially now that the CSA is aware of these new rule changes. Maybe they find a center back, you know, diamond in the rough, and he turns out to be, you know, the next top prospect in that position. But for right now, there just aren't a lot of options, which is what's kind of bleak about this whole thing. Question from Stefan Jordan. What did you take away from Herdman's comments about quote-unquote certain players using Canada as a bargaining chip in order to pursue other international opportunities elsewhere? Thomas, you mentioned it already, but here's what Herdman said about this to those who missed it.
There's a lot of players out there that, you know, have got dual passports, and you've got to keep it real. Like, I keep seeing all the names that are getting bandied around, but, you know, the reality is if they can play for a bigger association, for many of these agents and players, it's about the dollars first. This is what I'm learning. It's a short career, and they have to maximize their earnings during that period of time. And then when those opportunities sort of diminish, you know, that's where you have real conversations.
Some took that as a shot towards Fakayo Tomori. Thomas, what did you make of the comments?
I'm not surprised. I did think that he was talking specifically about Flores, though.
Possibly, yeah.
But yeah, I think, like you said, like every player's process is different, and these guys are going to try and go as high as possible as they can. And if they see that a country can help them get there, like Portugal, like Mexico, like England, France, you know, all these kind of countries, that they're going to do it as much as possible, because, or as long as they can, until they see that dream is no longer a reality.
Well, he is right. And all players have that right. They have short careers. Let them make the most of it. It's no different to any other walk of life. We all try to get further ahead by any means necessary. And it may have been a shot at Tomori. It may have been a shot at Flores. But you know what? Let them do what they want. I mean, they have their decisions. In Tomori's case, he grew up the vast majority of his life in England. He's good enough to play for them. If that's what he wants to do, then that is his right, quite frankly. And if Gareth Southgate and his coaching staff are so stupid that they're leaving him out, despite the fact that he probably is the best center back that they have, then, you know, let them do that. I think that when it comes to the players themselves, as I said last week, we got to be respectful of their decisions and just move on whenever they make them. We'll move over to the final question of this section from Rude Trude. When do you think Herdman will stop introducing new players into the fold? If Canada qualifies for Qatar, do you think he'll just stick with the players that got the team there, or will he be tempted to include new players that may be in form? What do you think, Thomas?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I would say it's either now, like the team has, is like, it's either the team has, will not change going forward. The rest of the players that are in the system will play the rest of the Ocho, and then see if Canada can qualify. And then you have to have two different conversations. One is this cycle that is left. And then if Canada makes it to the World Cup, you have 5 to 6 months. That is a substantial period. And a lot can change with clubs, with players' careers. So it is like just the biggest example I can give you, Peter, the center back depth. Cornelius was the best center back 2-3 years ago. Now he's no longer the case. In fact, I think if Kennedy was healthy, I think he wouldn't be part of the squad. But dual nationals will come to Canada when Canada qualifies. And I think this group of players will play the rest of this journey. And then once Canada qualifies, I think then you can entice players to come and play.
Yeah, I think you'll see it slow down after January as teams start to identify their best 23 and whatnot. I think Herman already has it in mind, apart from potential injuries and all that. But most new quote-unquote countries to tournaments aren't going to rotate their squads all that much leading up to the tournament. So I don't think we'll see it too much after that. Let's get into the rest of the squad here, because we did have other players obviously make the cut other than Ike Ugbo. No big surprises, really, with Scott Kennedy and Junior Hoilett injured for this window. David Wotherspoon made the cut despite an injury concern of his own. Atiba Hutchinson is back in the mix as well after returning from injury. We did see the inclusion of Lucas Cavallini, even though he has been out of form with Vancouver. But we did anticipate that he would be called up on the last episode, and that's exactly what happened. So we got a question on this topic from Stefan Jordan asking, Herdman talks about being in form. However, how does Cavallini continue to get called up? Your thoughts on this, Thomas?
Chemistry and just what he's done for the national team. I do think that we have to be careful here because, again, I think Cavallini, if Cavallini is in form in 2022, I would actually pick Cavallini over Ugbo. And I understand that right now that doesn't sound very logical, but Ugbo is a shiny new toy. We still don't know how good he's going to be with Canada. But Cavallini, yes, he's in no form, absolutely no form, and he shouldn't be there. But you have to think that he still has given a lot to this country, this national team, and he still has much more going forward. He just needs to play, whether that's in MLS, Mexico, maybe a move back to South America, or maybe a move, you know, to another European league. But I do think that we can't just shove Cavallini aside. Perhaps maybe after this window, Herman says, look, I'm going to call up other players in January, and if you're still not in form in March and going forward, then I'm not going to call you up. But I think this might be either the last slap on the wrist, I could say, that, hey, Cavallini, you have to get your shit together club-wise, or he'll still stay on as long as FIFA allows 23-man call-ups and whatnot, because maybe we don't know. Maybe FIFA decides that because of COVID, more expanded rosters.
It's true. It's true. Like we saw at the Euros. It's possible that Cavallini could be an asset against Mexico, given how he gets under players' skins. And if he works hard off the ball for Canada and, you know, maybe helps create a goal or scores a goal, then I think it'll be justified. But I think the issue is he's not doing any of this really at the moment in Vancouver since he lost his spot and got hurt. Form-wise, he doesn't deserve a call-up at all. And as you said, Thomas, it might, you know, potentially get him to seek a move elsewhere if he's dropped or to shape up in Vancouver because he looks really down at the moment. You mentioned the chemistry and the camaraderie, and look, like, that's probably why he didn't end up getting called up. On the one hand, I understand that, but I think it only really applies if there aren't any other big figures in the team. You have veterans in Milan Borien, Daniil Henry, Atiba Hutchinson, even the likes of Samuel Piet and Jonathan Osorio are experienced in the team, and you would probably consider them leaders in that team. You would think they can cope without Cavallini being in the squad, and if they can't, I think that speaks volumes. You know, and especially when you now have another striker added to the mix, that could send a message to Cavallini, because his spot has been guaranteed for quite a while, and probably up until a few months ago, you could say rightfully so. But now it's starting to look a little precarious. So for that reason, I do understand why fans are frustrated. But Herman has his reasons. And again, this could all end up being moot if Cavallini ends up scoring the winner against Mexico. And everyone's like, oh, you know what? It's fine. He can stay in the squad from here on out. But we shall see, of course.
I think if Boylan made the squad, Cavallini wouldn't be in the same.
Well, that transitions us nicely here. KenMNT/Valor at Canada Soccer Guy. If Hoilett and Kennedy were available, whose spot would they take? Who were three or four fringe players in the 23. So if Hoilett and Kennedy had made the squad, Thomas, who would they be replacing? I mean, Kennedy for Cornelius, you would say that would be the like-for-like change. But if Hoilett wasn't in, you would say Cavallini?
Yeah, 100%. There's no other doubt. In the midfield, I will say I was surprised that Herman did call up Wotherspoon over Fraser, considering that Fraser will be part of the next 3-4 cycles going forward. And Wotherspoon, you could say that this is his last his last cycle playing international football.
Ever since March, when Russell Tiber didn't get called up, you're just trying to burn David Wotherspoon to the ground, my friend. Jeez.
Not at all. I just I like Fraser, and I think when you have players that you know can be part of the next 10 to 12 years, I think you should use that.
Yeah, but I mean, also there's like what, three or four other guys who fill Fraser's role. There's only really one guy who can fill Wotherspoon's role, and that's Marc-Anthony Kay. So, in terms of Hoilett getting called up, the guy that you would replace, it really just depends who you want to essentially take out, because which position do you want to be a little lighter? Is it midfield or forward? If it's forward, Cavallini would be the obvious choice. Otherwise, maybe you look at someone like, say, a Liam Miller. I know it's difficult to drop him given his form, but consider this. Hoilett was a regular starter, and Miller isn't in that conversation yet. So it's therefore logical to drop a substitute for a starter, as good as he has been for Basel. You could also drop a midfielder like Wotherspoon, who isn't a regular starter, but again, you do lose one of your more attack-minded central midfielders when you do that. And honestly, Thomas, I wouldn't say that Kennedy for Cornelius would be as like slam dunk of a decision as it is, because Cornelius has improved a lot over the last few games. So that may not be a guarantee anymore come January, but you would have to say a match fit Kennedy, especially given how ingrained he is in the squad, probably still has the advantage in that regard. Speaking of center backs, Vince Alvarado asking, should Joel Waterman be getting call-ups to this team? He's been as good as Miller in recent times and is improving every week. Johnston also needs a backup, so his inclusion feels like a no-brainer. What do you think about this?
I think Waterman is the seventh center back in the pecking order. I would put James ahead of Waterman. Waterman, in my view, like he's on a cheap contract in Montreal, so he only has to do, as Vince is alluding to, only be just good enough in order to continue in the MLS, and he is playing, you know, regularly, which I think is helping. But for me, Waterman, I just don't see him as an impact player. And I do agree that yes, guys like Johnston shouldn't be playing center back anyways, but he is, right? And at the same time, I would say that, you know, Waterman is one of those fringe players, as the previous question alluded to. But again, I mean, center back, it's always a question mark.
Well, I disagree in some way. I think Johnston has more than earned that role at center back. And no one probably thought it was going to happen, but it did. So he has, and that's what matters here. Waterman would be a logical Johnston replacement. He's comfortable on the ball. He's used to the role. He's been in the squad before. He just has major, major issues defending in transition because he's quite slow and doesn't seem to have positional awareness when he's running back. And like I've seen him play in person a couple of times recently here, those haven't gone away at all. And Johnston has his faults, like, you know, aerial duels, for example. So it depends how much you want to balance risk and reward, but there are certainly an even number of both of those when you call up Joel Waterman. Once again, another question regarding the defense from Edward Hon Sing Wong. In case you missed, thoughts on Gutierrez being played as a center back at the Whitecaps? Seems like a waste given his abilities on the wing. But could this be another center back option like Johnston for the men's national team in the future? I would say probably not, because when you look at Gutierrez's strengths, Thomas, they are in his attacking instincts, progressions, crosses, forward runs, all that stuff. And he isn't as solid defensively as other players in that position would be. So, you know, he tends to get burned on the dribble. That could be a major issue. And I think someone asked about Adekubi playing in that role a few weeks ago. And the more I think about it, the more open I am to it, because Adekubi does have good awareness and positioning defensively. He's quick and good on the ball. So I could certainly see him fulfilling that role decently, certainly better than a Gutierrez would.
I would say only if Canada's depth was as weak as it is, but it does have, like you say, 6-7 options. Again, they're not world-class options, but you still have those options nonetheless. And the thing about Christian Gutierrez, it's so unfortunate that he joined the fold with Adekubi already in and Davies already playing in that role, because I think he could be used. I think he could be called up with Canada. And it's just a shame that Herman doesn't see him as part of that system, because, again, Adekubi and Davies, just there's no need for him. And Larrea, who also plays there. So it's unfortunate, I think.
He probably would, yes. Simon B, why aren't there any U20 friendlies from now until the tournament in summer 2022? That is probably what is needed the most right now before anything. Imagine the likes of Jebison, Mitrovic, Diash all getting called since we don't need the national team to cap tie. I would imagine the vast majority of those guys wouldn't be called into the under-20s, but, you know, I guess we can dream. This is where the FIFA windfall would be so massive, Thomas, because then you could have full youth camps with friendlies and therefore there'd be better preparation, but you're not going to see friendlies logically because there isn't a budget for it right now. Until then, and we've talked about this so many times, the best way to prepare is to have the under-20s come in as sparring partners. You establish certain tactical trends and, you know, work out the kinks that way until the tournament starts. But before then, it's just not really going to be possible.
You could say after 2022, it could be possible with the, quote, $15 million.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, that U20 team that was just mentioned, I mean, it, like you say, it does sound like a dream.
So let's dive into a preview of the first World Cup qualifier. The first match that awaits Canada is against Costa Rica on Friday, where more than 40,000 fans are expected to attend, perhaps more by then. How do you see Canada lining up for this one, Thomas?
No real surprises. Borjan takes the reins over Crepeau. Victoria Miller starting with Johnston, Larea as well. Atiba back in the 11. I think he'll okay. start this match along with Eustáquio and Kay. I think Osorio will be left out for the first match, and I think he'll play against Mexico. And I think Davies will go back up front. I really do believe that. I think he was super effective going more up front than he's used to. Laren slotted back into 11, although I could see a curveball by Herdman just because in the past we have seen Laren come off the bench, which I did not understand. And David, and I think the number one guy coming off the bench, if there is a change, is Buchanan. Like, he's the number one guy that has to be there. And if not him, as I mentioned already, Osorio, like, I think he's the other guy that would be on the fringe of the 11.
Yeah, we pretty much have the same 11 here. From right to left, we got Borjan, then Johnston, Victoria Miller. I have Larea, Osorio, Hutchinson, and Kay. Then Davies at left wing back. I still think he's going to probably end up dropping back there, but he'll probably play in a more free role because obviously with a little bit more space to run into, he can take that. And then I think Laren and David end up partnering each other again. I know that benching Buchanan is maybe seen as a little controversial, but not every player is going to be able to play. And, you know, perhaps Urban officer Buchanan over Larea at wing back. I personally can't see it. Reminder too, Buchanan didn't start against the U.S. with all these guys available. So it's kind of a nice luxury to have him come off the bench, as you said, Thomas. Otherwise, maybe 4-3-4-3 with Buchanan and one less midfielder, which I don't recommend. I know that Hutchinson over Eustáquio might seem a bit curious, but Eustáquio and Kay are a booking away from a suspension. And you would imagine the one guy you probably don't want to have suspended against Mexico would be Stefan Eustáquio. So I think Hutchinson replaces him here for this reason, because as great as Atiba is at his age, I think he's still about one step off the pace to play at as high of a level against a Mexico right now. So protect Eustáquio, replace him with the veteran, and then kind of go from there. That's how I see it right now. In terms of Costa Rica, areas to watch for them. There's obviously going to be no Keylor Navas, which is a pretty big loss for them, and probably increases Canada's chances of winning this game, in all likelihood. How do you see this playing out from a Costa Rican point of view?
Suarez is in big trouble.
Yes.
He regained some of that flair. Again, this actually brings me kind of... There's a saying you can't really study for the exam if you haven't done all the... You can't do one exam if you haven't done all the prep, but you can always catch up. And I think that's exactly what Suarez is doing. He was giving this team at the Gold Cup, didn't pick the team himself, and he has so many players available to his disposal playing in the MLS and whatnot that I don't think he even knows what his best 11 is. It's at a point where he's sort of experimenting still, and you can't be experimenting at this point. I mean... Jordan Diocho and a guy like Bolillo Gomez, who, which by the way, was named Honduran head coach. And I know that a guy like Gomez will come in and already know what his best 11 is. He wouldn't take on the role if he wasn't sure of it. But I would say that Costa Rica without Navas is huge, because I just think the game completely switches on its head. Like,
yeah.
Navas, in my view, is top three, top five goalie in the world. It changes things so much, because now Canada has to win.
Yeah,
I didn't think Canada had to win before. But now with Navas, I think it's 3 points or a failure for me.
Because he single-handedly can win you a game, or at least keep you in a game, right? And then all you need is one chance.
Like the same he did against Honduras. Like,
yeah.
Took away 2 points for them.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he did stand on his head against the U.S. in that game. Obviously, they lost that match, but kept them in it for a very, very long time. So not having him is obviously a major, major loss. Obviously, it's difficult to determine who exactly is going to start, but probably two of the certainties for Costa Rica would be Matarrita and Leal down the left, which is going to be Larrea's side. Obviously, Canada's right side I'm talking about. For the most part, Costa Rica play in a 4-4-2, but go 4-2-3-1 on the ball and then 4-4-2 off of it. And because Matarrita bombs forward and gets those overlaps going, that could be the route to goal. So, you know, try to get whoever it is down that right side, whether it's Larrea, whether it's, you know, Laren drifting over there, David drifting over there, Buchanan later in the game, maybe when Matarrita gets tired, that could be a major asset to have. That side is probably going to end up making or breaking the game for either team, though, you would imagine. After Canada welcomes Costa Rica on Friday, they're going to welcome Mexico on Tuesday night in what should be a scintillating game after their last two meetings. We will preview the Mexico game in depth in our post-match edition of the show following the Costa Rica match, but we did get a couple questions here from at W. Marpes. First question, he asked, how much do you think Herdman will rotate? And do we go with completely fresh legs for Mexico or go all out to build momentum? Because there are only two games and both are in the same city, Thomas, I don't think he really needs to. The only possible changes you're going to see are, like, you know, again, that Ostakio for Hutchinson change, maybe another forward, who knows? But it's going to be very minimal, I would think. You could maybe see a formation change. Maybe they go 4-4-2, given how well it's worked against Mexico. But that keeps you light in the midfield, and I think you need that against Mexico's trio for maximum protection and maximum coverage. So for that reason, I just can't see much, if any, rotation for this one.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the only thing, the only names that, again, it's so tempting not to put Buchanan in the starting 11, but it is also, at the same time, so hard to take Laren off the field. You just, yeah. You just can't. And like you said, the two yellow cards, I think that's important to watch out for, as you mentioned. But yeah, Osorio and Osorio, Atiba, Kay, I think the four guys, one of them won't be able to play. And I would even go as far as saying that I have a feeling, I don't know why, but I have a feeling that Herman will change something for that Mexico game. I have a feeling it won't be the same starting 11 against Costa Rica. And the reason I say that is because the back four or back five, back three, you know, however Herman decides to line up, you know, as much as Vitória and Miller have that chemistry, you might make a good point that, you know, Cornelius or even Henry, we could see them at some point. But at the same time, it's more than likely that they'll come on the last 30 minutes and whatnot. Piet probably last 30, 40 minutes, 35 maybe, or Buchanan as a substitute. Like, again, I think Herman will just stick with the same 11 and just plug in holes wherever he can, like as he's done.
Yeah, exactly, as he's done. And I mean, again, without them traveling, that's a massive advantage, whereas both of these teams are going to have to travel. So you got to use it to your advantage here. Final question from at W. Marpes. Do they play Ugbo at the end of the Mexico game if we're tied or losing? Yeah, absolutely. If the situation presents itself and Canada creates chances like they were at the Azteca, then you have to bring on someone like Ugbo. And Mexico's backline can't cope with fast attackers pressing them, so all the more reason to bring on someone like him in the second half, especially if you need a goal, for sure. Closing out the show here with some news and notes, mainly domestically. Some big news occurred last week as Forge became the first CPL team to qualify for the CCL after coming from behind to beat Santos 3-0 in the second leg of the CONCACAF League quarterfinals. They will now face Honduran side Motagua in the semis. Now, Thomas, we know the significance of this achievement for Forge, the CPL, and Canadian soccer as a whole, but Do you think this could lead to Bobby Smyrniotis getting an interview from an MLS club, whether it's Toronto FC or Vancouver Whitecaps, or do you think he will stick around to play in the Champions League or to coach in the Champions League?
Dropping a huge CPL bomb here. Bobby Smyrniotis sees that next year could be an opportunity for him to coach in the MLS, and he is in contact with at least one unnamed MLS club.
Boom. Nef bomb. Obviously, they do have to play a semifinal, Thomas, so what chance do you give Forge against Motagua?
I would say, well, look, I mean, last year they played against Marathon and gave them a run for their money, and you could even argue the same thing with Olympia until they really held off. I think the chances of this team, you know, beating Motagua and advancing to the final is just as good as any other team, although I would say Motagua is stronger than the team that they just played, Santos, off the Costa Rican League. I'm actually going to be working this game for Honduran Media, so got to brushing up on my Motagua notes here.
Indeed you do.
But yeah, you know, they do have, you know, some Honduran national team players that can do some damage. And it's insane, Peter, just how much I've been asked this question by Latin American media, just the recent year and whatnot, when Forge is playing in the CONCACAF League. Oh, you know, Forge, why don't they have any national team players? Any national team players? And the fact that the Forge players are playing on a pretty even playing field against teams that have, you know, Honduran national team players, Panamanian national team players, although there's not a lot of them, but it's crazy to me because the Canadian national team in the CPL is like completely different, like not even connected at all, in my opinion. And Forge is able to play against some players that, you know, Canada are playing. Like the team that, you know, Forge played against Municipal Domingo, like there's a couple of El Salvadoran players that, you know, played in this team, and that's incredible. So I think Smyrniotis definitely deserves that opportunity moving forward.
He does for sure. Speaking of the CPL, it's down to the wire as the regular season closes. Valor was eliminated from playoff contention after a crazy 3-3 draw with Edmonton on Saturday. York United slipped up and lost 2-1 to Forge, who ended up overtaking Pacific atop the table. That gave HFX Wanderers the chance to reclaim fourth place, but they slipped up and drew 1-1 with Atletico Ottawa on Sunday afternoon. That means York clinches the fourth and final playoff spot. So the four teams are determined. Seeding from first to third still yet to be determined, though, as a couple teams still have games in hand to make up here. In MLS, CF Montreal missed out on the playoffs after losing 2-0 to Orlando City on decision day. And just a few days prior to that match, CEO Kevin Gilmore stepped down from his role, citing pandemic and club-related issues over the last 18 months, as well as the impact, no pun intended, it's had on himself and his family. So it could be yet another hectic offseason in Montreal.
The Vancouver Whitecaps have advanced to the MLS playoffs after a 1-1 draw with the Seattle Sounders. They are the only Canadian MLS team to make the postseason.
And TFC lost 3-1 in their regular season finale with Richie Larea scoring the lone goal for Toronto.
TFC and Montreal will face each other in the Canadian Championship final as well.
And to close out the show, elsewhere in Vancouver, Ruben Tomlinson, LLP, has been assigned to handle the independent investigation into how the Vancouver Whitecaps handled sexual assault allegations in 2006 and 2011 involving Bob Berarda and Hubert Busby Jr., who was actually just recently relieved as coach of the Jamaican women's national team. Janice Rubin previously handled cases involving the Canadian Olympic Committee as well as the CBC, so she is quite used to these kinds of high-profile cases. We shall see what transpires from that independent investigation. So that is going to do it for us this week. Thank you, as always, for listening and for putting up with my very nasally voice this week. I promise you, when we record post-Costa Rica, it will be sounding a lot different. Until then, for Thomas Neff, I'm Peter Galindo. We will chat to you soon.